You're welcome to that.
Formulating very strongly at first, you're lying down the intention to fall awake. At this Saturday afternoon, a major occupational hazard to practice lying down meditation. It's always an occupational hazard that you might fall asleep. So with seamless continuity in your own being present. Now, if we were engaged in a longer retreat together, much of what's unfolded in the last 2 days would have been spaced out with a lot more silent time for practice and movement. A lot of sittings where the instructor might not say a word because you already have had the full repertoire of instructions, so to speak. And many of you, of course, have that anyway. But for the sake of completeness in this sitting, I will offer you a loving kindness meditation. In fact, from the moment we started together, it's been one seamless loving-kindness meditation. And if you haven't, in some sense, felt that, then you might as well take the rest of the afternoon off and not do the loving-kindness meditation. So the loving-kindness meditation is the one door into a room, but it's the same room as all the other doors. But it has its own virtues. So once again, establishing yourself either sitting or lying down, but in a posture that embodies full presence of heart and mind. Allowing your very taking of your seat to be a radical act of love and sanity and self-regard and wisdom and compassion. Moving from doing to simply being. And as I said earlier, that one can easily mistake the instructions of loving kindness to be more doing. It's not. So there's simply ways to incline the heart towards itself. They're not invitations to feel anything at all in particular. They're not imposing anything, but an invitation to incline in a particular way one's own heart. I'll give you a fairly abbreviated version of it. And it's on in under the name of Heartscape. On one of the CDs in Series 3 Guided Mindfulness Meditations that deals with coming to our senses. So establishing yourself in the present moment, full awareness. Inviting into this field of awareness another being, being can be alive or no longer alive, but someone who in life loved you or loves you unconditionally. And allowing yourself in this moment, if there is such a person, to bathe in that experience of being seen and felt and met and loved without any conditions, just as you are, just as you were. And if no person like this comes to mind, then allowing yourself to take that role for a moment and incline your own heart toward yourself in that way. And just bathing in the feelings of affection, acceptance, and kindness, and love as you sit here or lie here breathing. Almost as if you could breathe in the love, as if your body could soak in the acceptance. As if you could actually feel being bathed in unconditional acceptance, regard, kindness. It doesn't actually have to be a person, you know. It could also be an animal. But some being. Has accorded you, even for one moment, bathing in it as we sit here in our life. I'm not trying to force a feeling whatsoever, but to simply be with whatever feelings arise as we put out the welcome mat, so to speak, and open the door. The door of memory. The door of longing. And allowing whatever arises to simply arise. To be agenda to either sustain it or make it go away. No doing at all. Just bathing. Now, if there is a person in your life, or several people in your life, toward whom at this particular moment you would like to direct your own loving kindness, then inviting them into the field of your own heart in whatever way seems appropriate. An image, as a name, as a memory. And allowing them to bathe in this same energy that has been bathing you. So that there's a kind of flowing in and flowing out from you towards them, towards a one person or an animal. And if you can, becoming aware of the heart space in your own chest, and any sensations in this area of the body as you rest in this bathing and this radiating of loving kindness. And into this space, I'm going to introduce some phrases that you can wordlessly repeat to yourself or change and make your own. But starting now with ourselves, taking the energy that we experienced from another, who afforded us that embrace of kindness and unconditional love. May I be, directing it towards ourselves, may I be safe and free from inner and outer harm. May I be content and happy. May I be healthy to whatever degree possible in this moment. May I live with ease. Remember, I'm not suggesting you feel anything, but to just listen and resonate with the intention. May I be safe and free from harm, inner harm, outer harm, right in this moment. May I be happy. May I be content with things exactly as they are in this moment. May I be healthy, right in this moment, to whatever degree possible. May I live with ease. well-being. And just resting in this bathing, so to speak. Just embracing yourself with kindness. Saying those phrases or other phrases silently, wordlessly, however you'd like to do it to yourself. Bathing. And for now, really featuring yourself. So all of the energy is really embracing you as you are. Just as before, let's bring one or a number of people who we deeply, deeply care for. Or animals. The people we're close to, that we know well, that we want to wish well. And then silently to ourselves, may he, she, or they be safe and free from inner and outer harm. May he, she, or they be content and happy. May he, she, or they be healthy to whatever degree possible. May he, she, or they live with ease and well-being. Best you can, letting the energies just continue through repeating those phrases or other phrases, and through just the silent delivery, so to speak, the silent emanation of your own heart towards theirs with these wishes for well-being. Safety, kindness. And now into the space of the heart, if you care to. And only if you care to, try to think of somebody who you see quite regularly in your life, but is kind of what you'd call a kind of neutral person. You might not even know this person's name. You might have a very cursory relationship with them. And see if you can actually bring them into vivid focus in your heart, in your mind's eye. And for no reason other than that he or she is a human being, and like all human beings, desires to be safe and happy and to not be stressed and burdened and to not suffer and to be free. As vividly and as open-heartedly as possible, may he or she be safe and free from harm, inner and outer harm. May he or she be happy. May he or she be healthy. May he or she live with ease. Noting the effect that it has on you to wish this other person, you have such a cursory relationship with, well, to extend loving kindness to that person. Shifting to another person, not somebody who has done you tremendous harm, but somebody who just annoys the hell out of you, or somebody you have problems, you have trouble with, that it never goes well, or there's some falling out that perhaps has occurred. Where there's some sense of blame or hurt on your part or the other's part. And only if you care to. And selecting somebody that's, again, just mildly, you know, in that kind of relationship with you, not like the worst person in the world or somebody who just caused you major harm. And seeing just fine. Just if you care to experiment this way, bringing that person into the mind's eye and into your own heart. Often it might be a family member, but whoever it is, or a colleague at work, or an animal you don't get along with, may he or she be safe and free from harm. Not that you have to feel it, but that you're playing with that energy. May he or she be happy and contented. May he or she be healthy to whatever degree possible. May he or she live with ease. Seeing what emerges from you when you incline the heart toward them in this way. Again, continuing with the phrases, modifying the phrases, or just holding the person in your heart. In spite of the hurt, in spite of the annoyance, in spite of the may he, she be safe, be happy, be healthy, be well, with ease. Now as the practice continues and as you deepen this practice on your own, if you care to or have had experience with it, you can bring progressively more challenging people into this field. We're not going to do that today. But I'd like to now invite us to actually expand the field of embrace to include, as the Buddhists put it, all beings. Sometimes it's much easier to wish all beings well than one being. But for now, may all beings be safe natural phrase that inclining the heart may all be near and far, large and small, one blooded and cold blooded, set free from the heart. May all beings be happy. Buddha, in their own way. May all beings be healthy. Live out their lives. Be. May all beings live in peace. And just allowing yourself to resonate with those very energies sculpted by the thought and even more by the intention and the feeling inside. Why stop here? About the planet. May the entire planet be safe and free from harm. May the entire planet be at peace. Happy, if you will. May the entire planet be healthy, in balance. May the entire planet be harmonious. Noticing how big your own heart is at this moment. It's actually holding the entire planet. And we could go further, but we won't today. So in the closing moments of this meditation, just resting in awareness. Inside and in the aftermath of what you've just offered yourself, offered to others, and offered to this world. And allowing yourself to simply bathe in and resonate with whatever is here, as you rest in awareness, moment by moment, by moment. Thank you. noticing how the heart is inclined in this moment? Drawing in a deep, deep breath, right down into your pelvis and right up into the apices of the lungs behind the collarbones. And a deep breath of kindness. A vitality of yourself and just letting it wash. Palestinian-American poet named Naomi Shihab Nye. Maybe some of you know this poem. It's become quite popular. It's called Kindness. And it goes like this. Just drinking it in with your palm. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating chicken in the maze will stare out the window forever. Before you know the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see that this could be you, that he too was someone who traveled through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. Before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the claw. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world and says, "It is I you have been looking for. It is I you have been looking for." And then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow. Catches the thread of all sorrows, all only kindness. Only kindness that makes sense of it. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world and says, it is I you have been looking for, and then it goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So we've entered into the last hour of our time together. Believe me, if we spent 10 days together, it would still go by like that. If you want life extension, and you want to put things back on your telomeres, extend them out. It may be that the best way to do it is to spend more time in your moments. Capture more of your moments. Because we only have moments. I sometimes like to say we only have moments to live. And it's true. So if you want to live a long time, try being here for most of it. Even tiny little bit more, and maybe with a degree of kindness. When the heart contracts, awareness can know the heart is contracting. It doesn't have to fix it, it doesn't have to pretend, oh, it shouldn't be, and put on a smiley face and go out and be happy. But that knowing is itself a radical act of kindness. And it does liberate that conditioned contraction. Don't take my word for it. Play with it and see what happens. When someone comes and triggers in you, let yourself really feel it. It's okay. And then maybe inquiring, looking, seeing. Often we'll say, as you well know, because you're all therapists, so you tell this to people all the time, you know, when you say to somebody, what you make me so angry, you're giving that person an awful lot of power over you. And they have the power to make you angry. Isn't that great? Where do you, what role do you play in it? I'm an innocent bystander, total victim. Doubtful. Can you say? So see how much you participate in your own affective contraction. It's a worthy art form. And you can practice, as I said, I think in my talk, every time I take my seat, I now, I didn't used to, but more and more I come to see it as an act of love. Just to stop. An act of compassion. Just to not need to do one other thing for now. He's like an oxygen line straight into the heart. It doesn't mean you'll get stupid. If I meditate too much, I'm going to go into being, and then I won't accomplish anything, and then my life will be a failure. Yeah. Very improbable. Everybody I know who's into mindfulness gets a lot done, and we suffer from having too much to do. And we have to do that dynamical yoga balancing of email. And if you're young enough, texting and Facebook and Twitter and be all a buzz in the Twitter. But what we're talking about here is really an art form for a life form. And we're the life form. And the art form is how we live. Thoreau also said to develop the quality of the day, that is the highest of arts. Now, I was riffing earlier and kind of got lost in the liver about the gratitude towards the English language, and I want to complete that little thought. And you may have noticed it in the guided meditations that I actually use a lot of present participles. You can't do that in all languages. There are lots of languages, even languages that have present participles, they don't work like the way it works in English. So we really, really, really lucky. And what is the biggest virtue of the present participle? Well, there are two that I'll mention to you. One is that, and maybe you notice this in the guided meditations, I'm not using a command language. I'm not telling you what to do. Have you noticed that? I'm not using the interrogative, the imperative tense. If you can reach back into your grammar school days to, what the hell is he talking about, the imperative tense? It's command language. You do this, lift the leg, breathe in, breathe out, sit up, straight. I don't think you've heard me say any of that. Nevertheless, I've actually invited you to sit up straight, to breathe in, breathe out, to notice at least if you're breathing out, and it almost entirely with present participle. Breathing in. Then I don't have to say you breathe. Just breathing in, breathing out, noticing, letting go, letting be, opening, awarenessing, attending. Have you noticed that, or did it go by without even noticing? Yeah. You can make it artificial. I guarantee you can alienate virtually everybody if you do that too much. And it can make guided meditations nauseating. So again, it's an art form. It's not like a gimmick. And you have to make it yours. You can't. It's not imitate. You can't imitate it. But the real virtue of the present part was not that at all. The real virtue is that it avoids the whole duality between subject and object. When you're seeing, I don't have to appeal to a you that's seeing. There's just seeing. And it doesn't have to be like you separate from what is seen, the object. So subject and object duality, which is seriously problematic, since we don't even know who we are. Who's meditating, or any of that stuff? Who's seeing? But there is seeing. And so in a way, it allows us to invite non-dual essential element of practice into common experience and language in a way that can be embodied without even ever explaining or using the word non-dual or explaining anything. But The alternative is that you fall into reifying an observer, a you, a meditator, that just makes for another story about how great a meditator I am or how terrible a meditator I am. And then everything falls into the present, the personal pronouns, and we're off to the races again. You get the drift? I'm not going to give a big talk on this. But I do feel for completion's sake it's really important. Another thing that I feel for completion's sake, several people came up and said, well, this was built as like mindfulness in medicine and psychiatry or something like that. And then the subtitle was A First-Hand Taste in Clinical Application. So I think we're all agreed we got a first-hand taste. But as I reflected back on it, I've woven pretty much everything I would have said if I'd given you a PowerPoint presentation into what's unfolded over the course of these 2 days. So I don't feel badly about it at all, or defensive. That if we haven't touched on mindfulness in medicine, I don't know what we've done. Okay, this is it. And if we haven't touched on mindfulness in psychology and psychiatry and therapy, I don't know what we've done. Okay, this again is it. Is there more to say? Of course. But you can all go off. I see they've given you little diplomas or certificates of accomplishment or attendance at least or whatever. You can feel okay about that because we covered the subject now. And in terms of clinical applications, we've actually touched on a great deal of that as well. Is it endless? Yes. Okay. What's most important is the art form and the understanding out of which emerges. That understanding, you can read 100 books on Buddhism and be no closer to understanding than when you started. In fact, further. So, we have our work cut out for us. What else is there? Wasn't one thing, it'd be another. We might as well do what we love. Let, in Rumi's words, let the beauty we love be what we do. And then he said, beautifully, there are a hundred ways to kneel and kiss the earth. Not one, not John Kabat-Zinn's authoritative one right way, everybody else is off the beam. No one right way. Are there plenty of wrong ways? Absolutely. Delusion is out there and rampant. And it's in here and rampant, too. That's why awareness is so important. Awareness of our own delusion, awareness of our own unawareness. It's like, as far as I can see, almost the only thing we've got going for us. I think of mindfulness or awareness as the final common pathway of what makes us human. I'll just say that some interesting studies, fMRI studies of MBSR, people going through 8 weeks of training in MBSR out of Toronto, Zindel Siegel's group, a paper in 2007 by Norman Farr and a bunch of people, show that there are different networks in the brain for that are activated that are related to one's self-referencing. Okay? And I'm not going to go into the details of the study, but there are, these different brain regions light up, one in the medial frontal area, one in lateral areas. In the medial area, it has to do more with the personal pronouns and the story of me and the self-narrative. Well, if psychology, the study of the psyche, isn't about understanding the nature of self, I don't know what it is about. And now we've reached a point where we can actually interrogate the brain, so to speak, through all sorts of clever, not technology, but study designs that actually can differentiate and even uncouple that self-narrative that we all have. I mean, if I go up to you and say, who are you, just in a conventional way, you'll tell me who you are, and I'll know that it's not you, but you'll tell me your name, right? And by convention, we don't have to, it's like in an elevator, when someone says, how are you? You usually say, fine. You don't tell them the truth. They don't want to know it, and you don't want to tell it. Where the joke is, I'm not okay, you're not okay, and that's okay. So, in terms of clinical applications, if it turns out that 8 weeks of training in MBSR for people with a whole range of different kinds of medical problems that come, because MBSR, unlike MBCT, it's like the mouth of the funnel is gigantic. It's like anybody with stress, pain, or illness is potentially a candidate for MBSR. And we pour energy in what's right with people, not what's wrong with them. And we find that after 8 weeks in this study by Farb et al. 2007, that in 8 weeks, they're actually showing activity in different brain regions under certain circumstances, where they're no longer going into the story of me in relationship to certain kind of word triggers, but in fact they're going into direct moment-to-moment experience. It's a whole other way of being. It's my experiential self, so to speak, as a beyond name and form, as opposed to the story of me. Different brain regions. Well, this is like if you care about psychology, it's like this is the best time to live in. Because it's the study of the psyche where you're uniting interior, what used to be called a pejoratively subjective experience, with quote-unquote objective ways that we really don't understand at all, and they're very indirect ways of understanding what's going on in the organ, the brain, and the heart, which is, as you know, intimately connected with the brain. So this is a fantastic time to be a researcher in either the clinical domain or in the basic science domain. And I just want to say that so that there's a sense that we've really covered the territory here. That there hasn't been any kind of weaseling out of anything, at least as far as I feel. But actually a sort of decision tree as to what's most important in the very, very precious and fleeting time that we have together. None of us will ever be in this configuration, in a room together on this planet, ever again, in all likelihood. The probability of us reconstituting ourselves in this or some other room at some other point in time is finite. It's just extremely, extremely, extremely small. So this has been it. The future being uncertain, the past being over. But the present's not over. See, the present's never over. The highest form of, the Tibetans sometimes speak like this. The real meditation is what they call non-meditation. And they put a few descriptors in front of it. Undistracted, unfabricated, non-meditation. If you think you're meditating, you're not. I was really concerned when I did a study with Richard Davidson back in the day, quite a while ago, a randomized trial of MBSR in a work setting, where it was going to be a brain study and an immune study. We gave everybody a flu vaccine before and after the 8 weeks and followed their antibody titers to the flu vaccine and the control, which was a weight loss control in the experimental group. And we also looked at activity in various frontal and prefrontal regions that are asymmetrical in the brain. And in these regions, when they are active on the right side, you're getting a lot of sort of, usually it's associated with people who are high anxiety, high stress, high agitation. Just without any kind of intervention. They just, if you just, you know, do EEG on people's brains, when people have activation on the light, bright side, and even with children, they tend to have a temperament that is. And then there are other people who are more left activated, and it's like, you want to be near those people. It just somehow nice to be close to. And it was thought, until we did this study, that basically that was a kind of genetically set by adulthood set point, where you're either more left activated, right activated, and it's like pretty much that's the way that person is. And people will come into the stress reduction clinic, and the first thing they'll say to you is, I'm a stressed out person. I am a stressed out. That's what they'll say. They don't say, I'm stressed out. They say, I'm a stressed out person. I'm always stressed out. I was born stressed out. All I do is stress. I'm Miss Tension USA. People will tell you that. And then that comes along with the sense that it's very unlikely that I'll ever be different. Because I've been like this for 42 years. And we say, well, okay, but if you'd like, then we explain what this is and how hard it is. This is, would you agree at this point? I mean, this is just about the hardest work in the world, to just be aware for 1 second. Would you agree? Hard? Challenging, huh? Even harder if you're trying really hard. That makes it much worse. Much worse. How to get out of our own way. That's an art form. I like the joke, you know, you see birds flying in the sky. Have you ever seen pelicans? Like, you know, pelicans? You don't have pelicans here anymore. In the south of the United States and South America, and, you know, sort of warmer climates, the pelicans are just like, and they'll go like a whole troop of them, you know, and they skim over the water and they often don't need to beat to flap their wings. It's just a little bit something. And sometimes they just gain altitude, and then they'll just cruise along, and then all of a sudden they'll just dive bomb straight up and come up with a fish. And they're real good at this. You would not be so good at this. But I'll tell you, whether it's pelicans or seagulls or canaries or whatever, it's very, very unlikely that you've ever seen a bird flying along, and all of a sudden it kind of gets its wings all messed up together and just plummets to the earth. It just doesn't happen. They're like, I forgot left and right or something. It just doesn't happen. But you see that in human beings all the time. We get in our own way. We can't even walk through a door without banging into it. Sometimes. You know what I'm saying? Especially if we're really, really preoccupied. It's like a sign on the toilet, you know. Occupied. We are very occupied. Preoccupied. That's our default setting. In a certain way, the challenge is, can we, you know, alter the dials on the default mode? Can we reboot? I'm using computer language more and more because everybody's so wired, you know. But seriously, I mean, can we like reboot the system in the direction of loving kindness? You see an insect, and your first impulse isn't to crush it. But may you be happy. May you too be happy. Instead of, could my name. I need to kill it first. I'll tell you, had anybody noticed in the loving kindness meditation, did you notice any kind of feeling come up that was interesting to you? Did anybody notice any kind of feeling at all come up? It's not like we're pulling for feeling, but did anybody notice anything that was surprising to you or anything like that? Let's come to a microphone if you said yes, but let's have that microphone mic, you know, circulate. I'm really interested in in your experience, whatever it was.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Zoe.
Zoe? Hi, where are you from?
London.
London. It's not a trick question.
I had to think about that.
Yeah, it's not.
I don't know anymore.
That's good until you need to go home.
Yeah. I found the first part of the loving kindness meditation incredibly powerful. And I felt a real opening in my chest and my stomach, and just the whole top part of my body just felt like it was kind of cracking open. And it was receiving the love.
Yes.
And I just felt this incredible, I can feel this heat now. It just felt really hot, It was like I was just suddenly receiving all this love and realizing that most of the time I don't realize how much love there is. And I just felt incredibly grateful.
Right. So in a sense, if we're not aware of that, and we're depriving ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's almost like we're starving ourselves when the nourishment is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you noticed that even by the end, when we were using the phrases, because there were a lot of different aspects to that meditation. I'm not just asking this of you, but anybody, you know, because it may have been challenging, or it may have felt pedestrian, or it may have felt artificial. And sometimes we use those phrases, sometimes we won't, and just do it the way it started out doing. But who do you think is the most immediate beneficiary of that meditation? And that's why we always focus on me first, okay? It's not some kind of imperial ego thing. But this meditation is a profound benefit to us. We're giving ourselves love. We're inclining the heart towards recognizing what's beautiful in ourselves. And I think a lot of the time, I don't know about the UK, but in the US, a lot of the time, that's not where we spend most of our energy. In fact, we spend most of our energy in exactly the opposite way, condemning ourselves for being inadequate in one way or another, and unlovable and unworthy, and sometimes worse. So thank you for that. Do you have anything more you'd like to add?
It was wonderful that the timing of it for me, because professionally I'm leading an all-day retreat tomorrow as part of the 8-week course. And
what's your name?
Sorry?
Is Sophie?
No, Zoe.
Zoe. Yeah.
Lots of people call me Sophie.
No, I like Zoe. Well, I'll call you your name anyway. Sorry, I just forgot. So you're going to need a
I'm leading an all day tomorrow.
So
I've received many blessings for tomorrow. And I was wondering about the loving kindness and how I would do that, and feeling just the total importance of that practice even more after everything that you said since Wednesday night. And my felt sense from that experience is something about being able to bring into that initial practice of giving loving kindness to myself, being something about it being in relationship to other people.
Yeah.
And that I've done loving practice many times and it's never hit me in that way before. It just felt like even thinking of a moment of receiving unconditional love was just incredibly powerful.
Thank you. I'm happy to hear that, and that's why I usually or often start out that way, because it's such foreign territory to us. It could feel much too artificial to just sort of, may I be safe. But when you actually invoke the love of another, that most of us can at least find one moment in the X number of years that we've been alive, one moment, and sometimes it's that rare, but where somebody, and not necessarily a parent, but somebody actually saw you and loved you for who you were, without any exploitation, without any design, without any ulterior motive. Yeah, and so that lives inside you. Yeah, so enjoy the day tomorrow.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Anybody want to say anything at this point about the homework I assigned last night? If you remember it. Just get into bed and, so just be in touch with the body and applying and breathing. Waking up and actually remembering that you don't have to jump out of bed. Anybody do it? You said that you did it. Anybody want to say anything about it just briefly? Just to close that loop? Because you see, if you're teaching this or you're offering it to other people, it's not like you necessarily have to go 45 minutes sitting, with people. You could say, hey, listen, there are these moments, these transition moments at the beginning and the end of every day. How about you just spend a few breaths, full awareness as you drift off to sleep, a few breaths in the morning. It could change someone's life. Just that suggestion. I am a big fan of lying down meditation. If you do learn and train your body and heart and mind to fall awake rather than to fall asleep, there are a large number of circumstances where you are lying down, where you will be lying down, where you have to lie down, and to be able to recruit the full dimensionality of awareness, it's not like I have to sit or do something else. Very, very important. Very, very useful. So what we're doing in MBSR and DCT is we're fashioning, in some sense, and refining, and deeply refining, a whole toolkit, so to speak, a whole array of ways of relating to present moment experience. And just to say, in terms of experience, because I said that about subjective experience and objective experience, just to sort of tear the honesty scale around the science. No one has the slightest idea how we experience anything from the point of view of neuroscience. Maybe someday we will, maybe it will become like another uncertainty principle associated with complexity. The human brain being what it is, it may be kind of indeterminate in some way. So I don't think we'll ever come to the time where we actually can, know every possible option. This is, I don't think we'll even have that for chess, never mind for love. But, these are all valid scientific inquiries. But that science has to expand to look itself in the mirror enough to not claim to know more than it does. Okay? And when all is said and done, as I said, it's not about meditating to make beautiful fMRI patterns or to shift the set point, for instance, the study that I was talking about, it actually was the first study to demonstrate that we shifted the set point from right activation to left activation in 8 weeks. When you look at monks in the scanners, those monks, they're registering way, way out on the left, like Andromeda Galaxy, so, you know, not even this galaxy. You know, 8 standard deviations in some studies. But the fact that anybody, regular people like us, can with 8 weeks of MBSR training shift what was thought to be an unshiftable, genetic, kind of temperamental, fixed thing that has to do with emotional processing in the brain, because the prefrontal areas there regulate the limbic system and judgment and so forth and discernment, that we can shift that in 8 weeks is staggering. But still, nobody meditates to shift their prefrontal cortex. We're meditating so that we can feel more complete as a human being. So that we can be happy, you know, basically. I mean, the Dalai Lama likes to say this a lot. Everybody wants the same thing. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. That's a tremendous sort of point of convergence. And if you try, you go to the dry cleaners, and or, you know, if you pay the tolls, and there's some toll booth operator. I don't know if there's toll booths in the UK, but, you know, the people that you could glide by and not notice that they're human beings, and may you be happy. You don't have to say it to them, because, like, you know, they might think it really weird. But it's a really good practice for you to make you be happy, to the dry cleaning person, or to the waiter in the restaurant. Just inwardly, oh, a human being is serving me, not some automaton robot that it's all about my food, and how come it's cold. You hear what I'm saying? It's like there's no moment that's not a good moment for practicing. So the beginning of the day and the end of the day, beautiful place to sort of equilibrate. Small, tiny little commitments of this kind can make a huge difference. It's that image that I dropped into one of the meditations, you know, that thoughts actually self-liberate in awareness. It's like soap balls. And the more you are stabilized in the non-distraction, non-fabrication. Non-fabrication means don't build up so many stories. Non-distraction means the mind is so stabilized that when it feels itself going off, it comes back. These are not ideals. This is not now I feel incompetent because I'm only a meditator. I'm not a non-meditator. You know, these are just names for human experience and what's possible. Not as idealized states that we need to force ourselves into, but actually, there are aspects of experience that are present before our eyes in every moment. And your kids will point them out to you, especially if they're small and they live at home. But even if they're big, after a while they may stop pointing them out to you because they realize you never learn anything. You're just going to be the way you are. So this is a hell of an adventure, the world. So before we close out, and we're going to close out at 4:30, and there'll be an announcement at 4:30 about sort of like, I don't know what it is, but it has to do with this being some kind of green zone where if you're going to go, you should go at 4:30 because of traffic and that kind of thing. I don't understand it at all, but someone will announce it. And the other thing is if you want to stay, I have promised a lot of you that I will sign your books or talk with you, and I will do that. So at least until I collapse. But we're going to stop at 4:30. So it's 4:15. So we have an infinite number of moments between that now and this now. But it's only 15 minutes by the clock, and so we have to live in the various aspects of this very complex world. So I'd like to give you the last word. If there's anything left lingering, any sort of thing that I've forgotten or didn't mention, or that you have some concern, or you care to express something about your own experience, or for that matter, loop it back to why you came in the first place? The microphones are working. And I hope you'll actually, I think you'll actually agree with me that although there's the appearance that I was up here for the last 2 days leading this workshop, or whatever you want to call it, that actually that's only an appearance, that actually every single one of us in this room has been instrumental, whether we've said anything or not, has been instrumental in everybody else's experience in one way or another, simply by virtue of having shown up and participating together. And I just love that. I love that. This is what's called Indra's net. It's like the model of the universe in ancient Buddhism and Hinduism, where it's a net, that every node is a jewel, a multifaceted jewel, and all of the, and it hangs over the god, the palace of the great god Indra, who sometimes is male and sometimes is female, by the way. And the feature of this, the property of this net is that every single diamond in this infinite net is reflected in every single facet of every single diamond. So the whole is embedded, you know, it's like a holotropic, holographic model of the universe. So we are all embedded in each other in some way, and we are all each other's teachers. And I think as we've been here for the past really very short period of time, ways spoken and unspoken, we have touched each other and have, in some sense, affirmed wordlessly a community of what might be called a sangha of love, loving kindness, and intentionality, of inquiry, investigation. I mean, I don't know about you, but for those of you for whom this is work, I mean, they pay you for this? That's pretty good fortune. Seriously. And you know the world is starving for it. The world is starving for authenticity. The world is starving for embodied authenticity. And if I'm sure I'll have this experience, if you've changed even the slightest little bit. We're always changing, but if you've, in some sense, grown into some kind of deeper recognition of wholeness, the whole world's already, by virtue of the fact that we're all interconnected like Indra's net, the whole universe is already different. You don't have to go out and take on the universe and force change to happen and, you know, run through the Prochaska, you know, sort of stages of change. Isn't that a behaviorist, or a behavioral, or a cognitivist view of the world? It's a completely integrated view of the world, where our interconnectedness is foundational and fundamental. So, the microphones are open. And I'll stop us a little short of 4:30 and have a little closing ceremony. We'll see. I'll have to make something else.
Show up as a therapist in the room, and it's not I feel a hypocrite. Some of the time that I don't practice 30, 40 minutes, daily, 6 out of 7 days a week, even though sometimes I facilitate mindfulness with people.
So are you asking them to do more than you're doing?
Yeah, got a sneaky suspicion I'm not the only one.
Bad idea.
I recognize the importance.
And I appreciate your asking about it and your being honest.
It sounds crazy, I've even got a file fact with a to-do list in it. One of the things is practice mindfulness as if it's another thing to do, kind of thing.
Right.
My concern is fast forward 2 to 3 months from now, it kind of is taking a back seat.
Oh, you mean because this might inspire you to practice hard for a little while and then you know it'll tail off?
Yeah.
No, you don't. You don't know that. You're just interpolating that from your past behavior. I know, you're weighing probabilities and being realistic. This is the way I see it. Without being what we call in the U.S., in New York City where I grew up, a hard ass. One of our principles in the stress reduction clinic is we never ask anybody to do more than we're doing ourselves today, in the moment. It seems to me that's a professional commitment. So in the same way as we have, you know, all sorts of professional standards that we adhere to. If you affirm to yourself that that's your professional standard or one of your professional standards, you no longer slough off on that any more than you slough off on the standard of non-harm or breaking, you know, whatever the rules are of patient confidentiality or anything like that. I take it that seriously. That's why I've kept threading through that little phrase, that is sitting as if your life depended on it. It's not a joke. And it's not like, you know, just to hear myself talk. I see it as that important. So how can we teach this stuff if we're not practicing? It won't be this stuff. It'll be some, you know, denatured sort of you should, you know, kind of thing. And they'll figure it out immediately because people are much smarter. Everybody's smarter than we are. As soon as we're inauthentic, virtually everybody's a genius at inauthenticity detection. Everybody, even the people you think are like really out to lunch, the one thing they're really good at is inauthenticity. So you need to, in some sense, and I don't mean you, I mean all of us, in some sense, need to look in the mirror, take a deep look in the mirror, and ask ourselves what our priorities are, and why we're even doing this work. And then err on the side of honesty. And I won't say more than that. It's not a matter of time. It's not about, well, if you sit for 50 minutes or 45 minutes, then you can feel good about yourself. But if you sit for 42, then no. And then, of course, people will start to say, well, okay, how about we start negotiating down to, what, 8? You know, and that, I think that's best left for each individual person, to tell you the truth. If you also, and this is not a way to weasel out of it, but if you remind yourself that the real practice is your life, then you'll be practicing for a hell of a lot more than 40 minutes or 30 minutes, no matter what. And that 40 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever it is simply the kind of platform. Just is there a London Philharmonic Orchestra? I'm sure there is. Is it called the London Philharmonic Orchestra? Is it full of fantastic musicians that all play Stradivariuses and Greniches? Do they spend an hour tuning before they give a concert? Yes, they do. They don't say, hey, I'm a super musician and I got a great, you know, instrument and all these other people are fabulous musicians, so we'll just like, let's just go. No, they don't do that. They tune the instrument before they play it. That's what the formal meditation practice is. It's tuning the instrument or reminding and rebooting and rebodying ourselves, not in the service of something else, but in the service of the thing itself. And then it spills out into your entire day. And then there's not one moment that's not, in some sense, practice. Then you can walk into the classroom. You don't have to feel like a hypocrite, to use your word. You won't, because you're living this. And they will feel that. And they will then take to the practice in an entirely different way than if it's done mechanically and following some rule book, you know, that you just have to sweat it out for 8 weeks. And then you'll see that it was a really good thing to do. I hope that answers your question, because you're not going to get any more out of me today. Thank you. And so winds up, I was hoping we'd have at least 100 people speak, but we're going to stop here. First, I want to say that it's been I can't even express what a delight it's been to be here with you. I'll carry it with me, I know I will, for a long time. And, you know, there's a way in which, when we ring these bells, there's the moment that the bells kiss, but then the sound goes on. You could look at our 2 days, or two, if you came to the talk, 2 days and an evening, you could look at whatever time that we've been together as the kiss. But the real work, the real flowering of our time together doesn't end here. It's just like every breath is a new beginning. Coming out of a gathering like this is for me too. I would have to be insensate not to be touched by you. A lot of this is in the domain of the mysterious. It's not like, well, we know where this is all going. We don't know where the science is going. We don't know where the clinical development is going. We don't know where we're going. All we know is that we only have moments to live, and the human lifetime, even an extended, happy, not dealing with too much of the full catastrophe one, is over like that. So, you know, if we waste our moments, out of a certain kind of ignorance or delusion, we're really causing ourselves tremendous harm. But to me, it's not a good motivating factor to practice out of fear. Why not practice out of love? And so I'll make a deal with you, okay? I'll come back to Oxford sometime in the next 30 or 40 years and check in and see how you're doing. How would that be? And then we'll have, you know, some people will, you know, who knows? But you don't need me to check in and see how you're doing. How about you check in and see how you're doing? Every once in a while, maybe moment by moment even. So let's just take a moment to, with our eyes open, to just drop into the body. Our old friend, the body. Whether we're lying down or sitting and adopting a posture that, in some sense, just embraces the richness of the present moment. And then let's do a little twisting, like spinal twisting, only it's not going to be a formal yogic spinal twist, but just start turning your head and body and allowing yourself to make eye contact and to drink in the other people in the room. Whether you know them or not, but to really drink them in. And also incline your heart, or notice if it's possible to simply radiate an appreciation for each one of us packaged in our own little body, life packaged up in bodies, but really sharing something so profound that we have in common. And part of it's been our very willingness to show up, our presence here. And whether you've come from, you know, the far end of the earth, or from the local pub, you know, just recognizing that in some sense we're all in this together. And if each one of us, as I've said several times, takes responsibility for just the domain that's ours to take responsibility out of love, not out of fear, we'll be doing pretty much the best we can. And that doing, whatever the doing part of it is, will be coming out of being. And therefore, will be insanely beautiful. So I want to leave you with a couple of lines of poetry. First, remember the quick now, here, now, always, ridiculous, the waste, sad time, stretching before and after from T.S. Eliot. Later on, in the last stanza of Little Giddy, another one of the four quartets, it says, quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, in parenthesis, costing not less than. T.S. Eliot, somehow, in his completely disturbed life, found it, understood it, and then he says, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. You all know this, it's very famous. And he's an American, by the way, but he seemed like more English than me. We shall not cease from exploration in the end of all our exploring. All our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning, at the end of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children, of course we have the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, through stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now. Here. A condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. So there's your answer. And all shall be well. As long as we're willing to pay the price. And here's the last poem. Derek Walcott, Nobel laureate. St. Lucia in the Caribbean. I took one line of this poem for a little book that some of you have been asking me to sign, called The Riding of the Door. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror. And each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. You will love again stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to yourself. To the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you have ignored for another, easy to do, who knows you by heart, take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes, peel your own image from the mirror, peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast. So that's an interesting invitation. Sit. Feast. And life. Safe journey. Once again, just express gratitude to the Oxford Center for Cognitive Therapy for inviting me to offer this two-day retreat. Thank you. And as I said, I will, you know, stay for a bit. But Mark, is somebody going to make an announcement about this? Yes.